Welcome. You're listening to the Community Conversations podcast published by Blood Advances, a journal of the American Society of Hematology. My name is Dr. Margaret Ragney, professor of medicine at the University of Pittsburgh and associate editor of Blood Advances. I'm your host for today's interview with Dr. Walter Aruda from the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia Research Institute. We are discussing his recently published manuscript entitled Complete Correction of Hemophilia B Phenotype by Factor IX Padua Skeletal Muscle Gene Therapy in an Inhibitor-Prone Dog Model. Thank you for joining us. So we're very interested in this paper, Dr. Aruda, and I think it might be really helpful if you could describe the Padua Factor IX gene and why it is the, capital T-H-E, factor 9 gene to use in hemophilia B therapy.
Well, thank you, Dr. Ragney. Certainly, I'll be happy to explain our ideas about this project, in particularly moving toward skeletal muscle gene therapy. So we focus on the use of the factor 9 variant Padua, which is doing a amino acid substitution, arginine 338, to a leucine that was identified in a patient in Italy with have a deep venous thrombosis. And the importance of that find was that the levels of factor 9 were above 700% of the normal clotting activity, but with the normal circulant antigen, which raised the point that that was a protein with a gain of function. Therefore, we would fulfill our desire in terms of gene therapy to use a hyperactivity factor 9 that allowed us to lower the vector dose. As in many gene therapy, the lower the vector dose, the higher this efficacy profile of a given approach. Therefore, that allowed us to test this in animal preclinical models. And nowadays, we know that it is stable and safely expressed in humans following liver gene therapy in a very similar specific activity of the protein, which is around 8 to 10 fold of the normal. Therefore, together with a collection of preclinical data in dogs with severe hemophilia B, doing both a missense mutation or a early stop code that we call inhibitor-prone dogs, we learned that the immunogenicity of factor 9 Padua is not increased. Therefore, make a safe approach and allowed us to lower the vector dose.
That's great. What a wonderful find. So are there any patient factor 9 genotypes for which this sort of muscle-based vector technology might be unsuccessful? And would it be successful for a factor 8 gene?
For factor 8 gene, at this point, we do not have experience with that. There is only a possibility that can be done, but I'm not aware of anybody who have expressed factor 8 in the skeletal muscle. Technically, should be possible because it's like factor 9 is a secreted protein. Whether the immunogenicity or the complexity or the intrinsic production of factor 8 will be different in the skeletal muscle rather than liver or LSAC, we don't know at this point. But in theory, it's possible. And we are actually curious about that.
Yeah. So the route that you used, transvenular rather than intramuscular, could you comment on that and which veins you used?
Sure. As you know, our very first trial in hemophilia patients was actually by intramuscular injection, direct intramuscular injection. The problem is that we needed to keep the vector dose per site to a certain level to avoid overexpression of the protein locally, and therefore this was associated with formation of inhibitors to factor 9 in preclinical models, and this I meant hemophilia B dogs. And we learned that that was are accompanied by several safety concerns. Therefore, when we desire the intramuscular trial, we have to divide the vector dose throughout, you know, the 12 injection sites in the first dose cohort, but we come close to above 90 injection sites in the higher dose cohort, and therefore is not feasible.
Yeah.
Well, the intravascular route that we are using actually is a long-standing collaboration with people interested in developing a systemic delivery to skeletal muscle in patients with Duchenne muscular dystrophy. Pretty much what we did, we borrowed their idea that you can perfuse one limb, and by increasing the hydrostatic pressure and inject the vector, this makes a stabilization of the post-capillary vein. And that is the way that we can go into a limb, and you have, instead of to be punctual expression, you take advantage of the extensive vascularization of the skeletal muscle.
Could you provide a perspective on the problem of immune response to AAV-directed gene therapy, and specifically to factor 9 and to factor 8 for dogs and in clinical trials, and what do you think accounts for the reduction in the immune response in the current vector design and current vector design technologies?
Two points there. One is against the transgene, and the second is triggered by the AAV-mediated capsid. So the AAV-mediated capsid, the immune response, the better strategy that we learned over the years is that lower the vector dose in general. So there is a threshold that a level above certain levels depend on the vector system, AAV serotype, how the vector is made. This the trigger of the immune response will be different. So therefore, one safety approach is lower the vector dose. In terms of immune response to the transgene, we do not have that following liver-directed gene therapy. Actually, we're able to tolerize dogs with pre-existing inhibitors to factor 8 or to factor 9 by doing liver-specific expression of the factor 8 or factor 9. You can tolerize. Can the muscle be used for tolerization? So this was a question at the beginning. We thought that we could not. As you know, we use intramuscular injection to induce immune response like vaccine. So the idea was that maybe skeletal muscle does not have a tendency to induce immune tolerance. Emerging evidence now suggests that there is a local population of T regulatory cell into the skeletal muscle that might allow us to take advantage of that in some systems. Here, what we learned in this specific paper, what we did was a combination of two things. First, we went to this dog with an early stop cord, which is a dog when they give canine factor 9 concentrate, they develop inhibitors. That's what we call inhibitor prone. And the second is that we chose the skeletal muscle because it's not biased towards immune tolerance as the liver is. Therefore, we thought that that was the most extreme challenging scenario to test whether this, number one, is efficacious, and number two, is safe. So we learned from these dogs that we actually delivered the vector by intravascular route, was associated with a correction in one animal, and the other animal become a mild patient, mild phenotype, sorry. And we challenged these dogs over a longer period of time with concentrate of canine factor 9 wild type. And the idea was that we can look whether the immune response will be suppressed. And second, we think that this will mimic the clinical scenario which patients expressing part from the muscle, 10 to 20% or not 100%, but eventually when they need to get 100%, we'll have to replace the wild type factor 9. Therefore, we thought that was the most stringent way to look into that. So that's why we challenged the animals over a long period of time and with a wild type factor 9, and therefore we confirmed that we induce tolerance not only to the pattern, but as well as to the wild type. And I think this is an important concept in terms of translational potential.
So do you think the approach would work similarly in humans? And if so, how might you scale it up in human clinical trials?
I think here that, again, we can take advantage of ongoing clinical trials from Duchenne muscular dystrophy and other muscular dystrophies. They're moving now from not only adults, but also in pediatric patients. What we learned, first of all, with the elevated hydrostatic pressure, this is very well tolerized by even patients with Duchenne muscular dystrophy. They receive only saline, no vector, only the saline, and mimicking the delivery. And was the safety profile was quite good. So therefore, you feel comfortable, especially hemophilia, the muscle is much better shape than, you know, a muscular dystrophy patient. Second is that we think that the vector dose that we're going to need is much lower than the vector dose they require for muscular dystrophy, because they need to transduce extensive area the muscle. We just need to transduce certain part of the muscle. As long as the factor 9 is secreted in the circulation, we should be fine. So I think our safety profile will be considerable, attractive, because the delivery is safe, and the vector dose that we will require might be necessarily be lower than the Duchenne muscular dystrophy. But now we have to compare that with the liver. And what we learned with this experiment in these dogs, that is the first time that we are able to completely correct the disease phenotype by expressing PADO, which in the past we always thought that we express 5 to 10-fold less in the muscle, but a given dose of the same serotype if you put in the liver. So by combination of the hyperactive and the delivery, I think we actually narrow the difference between liver and skeletal muscle.
Now that's really something. So a quick question about your, I think there was transient immunosuppression that you administered. Was that just really simply because the dogs are inhibitor prone and it would really not have to do with use in a clinical trial?
Yeah, the rationale behind that is we learned that before we did an experiment in using canine factor 9 wild type in a missense dog that we to test this delivery. And we learned that if we skip cyclophosphamide, which was the transient immunosuppressor in dogs that we are more familiar with, it's not that we want to do that in people. But we learned that if you remove the immunosuppression, one out of the two dogs made a transient low-titer inhibitor that eventually disappeared. The other one did not. So we felt that in the dog model, at least, is a minor risk, is a transient, because we stop immunosuppression 5 weeks after gene delivery, and we follow them for over, you know, years, and we never have any evidenced immune response. Whether this will be required for humans, at this point, I think, again, we will learn from the muscular dystrophy, because the patients in muscular dystrophy, they have a more aggressive immune response to microdystrophin. And the trials ongoing and planned trials, actually, they will start with prednisone and with the therapeutic dose, and then they will monitor over time and taper that down. So I think that also, as we learn, some of the patients in the liver trial also require transient immunosuppression. So therefore, I believe that if we need to do this preemptively, like just every patient, we put them on some sort of oral immunosuppression, will be in terms, will be safe without the risk of a immune response. So whether we'll have immune response because of the patient mutation, this case is different. Like by studying these dogs, we learned that even inhibitor-prone dogs, they don't make antibody if you do a transient immunosuppression. And the other, as I mentioned, one out of the two without immunosuppression, missense mutation dogs, one did a very low titer of inhibitor. So we thought the risk and benefit or have a transient immunosuppression, advance towards benefit.
Right, right. So that's really exciting information. So maybe we sort of tie this all up here and ask you finally, where do you see muscle-based gene therapy fitting into the evolving development of hemophilia gene therapy?
Right. I think one problem that the idea of the muscle is that patients that we are not be eligible for liver gene therapy because underlying liver disease will be one potential candidate for that, because unfortunately we cannot test the safety of a liver gene therapy in a model of hepatitis or which is mostly the problem with patients above 35 years old in this country. And in many other countries, even younger patients, they do have, unfortunately, underlying liver disease by the transfusion of blood-borne diseases. And the second is the evidence is not very big, but promising that if you have a low titer of neutralized antibody to the AAV capsid, because you do this locally instead of to be intravenous systemically, you might be also able to amend patients with a low titer or neutralized antibody to the AAV capsid and yet be able to have a transduction efficiently. How we did this, we have dogs that we in the past, we inject AAV2 into the skeletal muscle by IM injection. And years later, we use this intravascular delivery, and we change the serotype. They cross-react a little bit, but we are able to actually upregulate expression.
So that's very exciting, given that over half of our patients have AAV antibodies and may be ineligible for standard gene therapy through the liver. That's very exciting.
That's correct. So as I said, we need to extend the numbers and make more provocative studies, but it might be possible that we can overcome a little bit that the presence of neutralized antibody have more people eligible.
Well, Dr. Rudy, you're always doing fascinating work, and I always keep tuned to hear what you're doing, but I really want to thank you for taking this time to talk with our Blood Advances audience about your really incredibly exciting research. Thanks so much.
I am the one who should thank a lot, Meg. It was always a pleasure.
Okay.
You've been listening to Blood Advances Community Conversations. Visit bloodadvances.org to listen to more author interviews and to subscribe to the Community Conversations podcast. Music for the Blood Advances Community Conversations was performed by the Art Topolo Trio and provided by Dr. Art Topolo. This presentation is copyrighted by the American Society of Hematology. We thank you for listening.